One of the more delightful Christmas gifts I ever gave myself was this one that I stumbled upon some 8 or 9 years ago when I was in the midst of trying to figure out what to get for whom and making myself a little crazy in the process and getting a little exasperated and slipping into one of those bah humbug moods that I do get a little susceptible to now and then. It was in the middle of that kind of feeling that I was in a bookstore and I happened to see this little book here by John Grisham called Skipping Christmas. I think it grabbed me because the title, as I say, just kind of happened to catch my mood at the moment. Yeah, not a bad idea, you know, I look at it like that. Grisham, as you probably know, is, I guess you could call him a pop novelist. He's a former lawyer, maybe he still is one, I'm not sure, but he discovered that he had a great gift for storytelling, and he used that gift to turn out a number of works, some of which were made into movies, books like The Pelican Brief, The Chamber, The Runaway Jury, The Firm, books like that. I call these books airplane books. I buy one when I know I'm going to be spending most of the day on a plane or in airports, because they're kind of like fast food for your mind. You know, they fill up a lot of hours and don't require a whole lot of thought, which is all I'm looking for when I'm traveling from trying to get from one place to another. Well, there are no lawyers to be found anywhere in Grisham's book, Skipping Christmas. The principal characters are instead no lawyers this time, but a tax accountant. Tax accountant named Luther Crank and his wife, Nora. It's a little, as you can see, it's a very short little book. It's not even 200 pages long. Kind of makes me wonder, maybe Grisham wrote it while he was on an airplane going somewhere or something. And this backstory, the book has been out for a while, and maybe some of you are familiar with it, but I'm going to give it a little reprise here. Thinking back to last Sunday, this is nothing like that existentialist theater of the absurd Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot play that we looked at last Sunday. This is just a plain old laugh out loud and in the end feel-good book and really makes no pretension of being anything else. I figure we don't have to operate on the Samuel Beckett level every single Sunday in here. A little lightheartedness is good for the soul once in a while, and there's one thing we're about here. It is doing good things for the soul. So here's the story. Luther and Nora live in an unnamed northeastern town or suburb, and one year they decide to avoid all of the usual holiday craziness, including gift giving and gift receiving, by having absolutely nothing to do with Christmas. Their only child, a grown daughter, is off in the Peace Corps in some other part of the world. They have no other family close by, and so they've just got themselves. Luther, as noted, is a tax accountant, and at some point towards the end of the summer, as the summer is giving way to fall, he does a little bit of a number crunching, already thinking ahead to the holiday season. He does a little number crunching, and he comes to the conclusion that for half of what he and Nora spent on Christmas the year before, they could take that and go on a 10-day Caribbean cruise starting on Christmas Day, which is exactly what they decide they want to do. And in so doing, they take a very solemn pledge to one another. No nothing. No Christmas. No presents. No house decorations. No parties or house gatherings hosted. No cards sent out. No baking or cooking. No going to office parties. Nothing at all. Instead, they're going to spend quiet evenings at home and eat sparingly so as to lose a few pounds before hitting the sunny Caribbean beaches. Okay, first two-thirds of the book then are about how this decision on the part of the Cranks affects everybody else around them. And with just a few exceptions, poor old Luther and Nora become neighborhood pariahs. They become the talk of the town in ways that no one would ever want to be the talk of the town. To give but one example, which is illustrated on this book's cover, you probably can't see it too well. It shows this whole neighborhood full of lighted houses. There's one dark one right in the middle of it. And what they do is Luther refuses to put a gigantic, inflated, lighted Frosty the Snowman up on his roof in the way that everybody else on the block does. This is completely in keeping with his refusal, as I say, to decorate his house in any way. And Luther's great refusal then consequently causes his block to lose the townwide competition for best decorated neighborhood, something they had always won in previous years. And shortly thereafter, Luther and Nora find protest signs on their front lawn urging them to free Frosty the Snowman. And it gets even better and even crazier and even funnier from there. So as I say, about the first two-thirds or three-quarters of this little book here, Grisham manages to hold up to ridicule just about every kind of way in which reasonably comfortable, reasonably affluent, tight middle-class Americans have managed to over-aggrandize, trivialize, shamelessly exploit, or otherwise demean the Christmas and broader holiday season. And since the author is able to do all this without getting real preachy or real self-righteous about it, all you can do is just kind of laugh along with him as he goes with it, which in a lot of ways constitutes laughing at yourself for getting caught up in a lot of the stuff that he is making sport of and having such fun with. And I found as I read this thing, and this may have gone for most readers too, kind of start rooting for Luther and Nora at some point, and then you say, okay, come on, guys, just hang in there for a few more days, and you're going to make it, and you're going to be down there in the sand and the sun and get what you really need and get your payback for all the grief you've been putting up with. Okay. And like most readers, I would imagine, I breezed through this thing, figuring that at some point, my chain would get jerked, or in this case, my heartstrings pulled, which, of course, is what happens. You know there's going to be a punchline in this thing somewhere, and this is what it is. 2 days before Christmas, Luther and Nora get an excited call from their Peace Corps daughter, saying she's been able to work out a last-minute arrangement with her Peace Corps superiors to come home for Christmas. And what's more, she's bringing along her brand-new South American boyfriend named Enrique, because she wants to show Enrique all the great and wonderful ways her family has celebrated Christmas over the years, just the way she did when she was a little girl growing up. Standing there in their completely de-Christmasized home, Luther and Nora have themselves one great big OMG moment. Well, if you haven't done so already, you can read the book to learn about all the frantic scrambling around they do to make everything, you know, they got 48 hours to make everything right for their dear old daughter and boyfriend, including getting Frosty the Snowman up on the roof, which Luther pays a physical price for that by slipping off the roof and nearly breaking his leg. I mean, it all gets pretty crazy. And then, of course, there's got to be a breakout the violins part. And that comes when Luther takes the cruise tickets with which he had been planning to spend. He takes them down to a woman in the neighborhood named Bev, who's just been diagnosed with cancer and who, while still well enough to travel, is probably experiencing her last Christmas. And so she and her husband, Walt, get to take the Cranks cruise. And everybody goes, ah, gosh, gee whiz, that Grisham guy really has a big heart after all. Well, okay, it's kind of corny and it's kind of hokey and it gets a tad maudlin here and there as it goes for the easy laugh as well as the quick tear. And while Grisham is no Charles Dickens, the feel-good ending here is only a few degrees removed, a very few degrees of that, from Dickens' A Christmas Carol, or from Frank Capra's tale of Jimmy Stewart's George Bailey, in the holiday classic film, It's a Wonderful Life. So I guess if there's any sort of larger message to be gleaned here from just kind of getting a kick out of a book like this, I would say it's this. However you do or do not celebrate this season, whatever you do and don't celebrate, however much you may embrace it on the one hand or shut it on the other, it seems like in some power or other, sooner or later, one way or another, it has a way of getting you. How then to receive it? And for me, the key word there is receive. For the question I try to keep before me as this time of year comes around, how do I best keep myself in a receptive mode in the midst of the craziness that I have come to recognize and really reconcile myself to as being just part of the whole holiday package? And moving beyond the personal, I would pose this same question, especially for those for whom, for any number of reasons, this time of year may be difficult or challenging or even painful. How do I keep myself open for whatever gifts, especially gifts of the Spirit, that this season may offer me? For a gift, after all, is only a gift when it has a grateful and a gracious receiver. Well, I have two pieces of personal scripture to offer along this line this morning. Personal scripture, I know that's a term I use from time to time also. It is, for me, it's a passage, some writing that has very little to do with whatever may have been canonized in any official way, in any official religious tradition, although it could include some of that. Personal scripture, as I've come to embrace it, are those usually brief passages of writing that have stayed with me over the years and to which I return from time to time to be nurtured again by their message. When Roy put out the invitation for the New Year's Potpourri service, which will be on December the 27th this year, I think that was what he was asking. What are some little bits of personal scripture that you want to come and share when it's kind of a potluck service? Well, my two pieces of scripture I'm going to offer here are, the first one is written by the late Clark Dewey Wells, a Unitarian Universalist minister, and the writer Annie Dillard. I know Clark Wells' piece is one that I've often invoked from time to time because that's what good scripture is, something you can come back to from time to time and still be captured by it, still be nurtured by it. He wrote a piece quite a number of years ago called The Nicest Gifts I Ever Got. It's part of a collection of meditations he published under the title of Sunshine and Rain at Once. With just some slight editing, here's his piece. During this season of gift giving, a good exercise is to make a list of the best gifts we have ever received. That will tell us what's important for ourselves and for those who receive gifts from us. While I remember a Daniel Boone hat and a magician's set with special affection, the nicest gifts I ever received are in quite another category. The Carol Rainier at Rockefeller Chapel, who let me strike one of the largest bells in the world during his playing at Mein Festenberg. My mother giving me a complete set of Shakespeare for my 14th birthday. Coach Al Terry saying, "Wells, grab your helmet," and permitting me as a freshman to enter my first varsity football game. A beautiful lady on a ship when I was still an active teenager who kissed me, told me I was handsome. Dr. Henry Nelson Wyman telling me he had thought for several hours about a question I had raised and responded with a written answer the next day in front of the whole class. Night after night, my father playing catch with me in the backyard until it got so dark we couldn't see the ball. A Unitarian minister in Kalamazoo who put his arm around me after my father died and kept it there for a long time. A friend who flew several hundred miles to visit me when I was sick. A buddy who went to see three movies with me on the same day. The nicest gifts people have given me, the best gifts I've received, have been enabling, confirming gifts, bestowing understanding and self-esteem, help in times of trouble, and delight for ordinary days. And then Clark concludes with this bit of advice and an invitation. May I suggest that you too draw up your list of the best gifts you've ever received. I think they will give you some perspective as to the kind of gifts we really want to give to others and receive from others any time of year. Confirming gifts, bestowing understanding, help in times of trouble, and delight for ordinary days. These are not, for the most part, the kinds of gifts we can deliberately or specifically seek out, or even deliberately or specifically ask for. I think what we must do instead is maintain a mood or an attitude of receptivity and openness so we can take them in and be ready for them whenever they come our way, and then be blessed by them. For that is what makes it them gifts. That is what allows us to say to our givers, in the deepest and the truest sense of the word, some words we sing here on many Sundays, "From you I receive." Taking this idea a step one further, beyond the sentiments of Reverend Wells, there's also a kind of, I would call it, cosmic receptivity we can attune ourselves to, which offers, I think, an overlay to the many gifts that we do receive, gifts of both material and spirit. For to be a good receiver, in this more ultimate or elevated sense, involves being able to see yourself within the workings of some greater, larger reality, however you may sense it, however you may name it. For all of our liberal religious and humanistic emphasis upon the strength and the power of the human mind and the human will, and I consider those to be very wonderful gifts, the truth still remains that we did not will ourselves or think ourselves into existence. And we live and we move and we have our being as part of a larger drama that we did not write. To be sure, we have some say-so. We do exercise a fair degree of free will as to how we will act in that drama in which we participate. But part of being a good receiver, in this more ultimate sense, is to keep oneself open to those moments where you see that you really are participants in a larger life. In a paradoxical kind of a way, coming to such an awareness can be more empowering than diminishing. I think it's possible to be both overwhelmed and empowered all at the same time. And this is what gets me to that final piece of scripture, the one from Annie Dillard, contained in her book, A Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which was published some 30 years ago. Ms. Dillard's book is something of a spiritual and kind of mystical diary that she kept during a stretch of time that she lived in the Thoreau-like cabin in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia near a stream called Tinker Creek. Later, she and her husband, for a time, moved actually closer to Thoreau's old haunts. They lived down in Concord, Massachusetts for a while before more recently returning to the South. This is a scripture that I take from Annie Dillard's writing with just a little bit of tweaking, written during her Tinker Creek days. Last year, I saw three migrating Canada geese flying low over the frozen duck pond where I stood. I heard a heart-stopping burst of speed before I saw them. I felt flayed air slap my face. They thundered across the pond and back again. I swear I have never seen such speed, such single-mindedness, such flailing of wings. They froze the duck pond as they flew. They rang the air. They disappeared. I think of this now. And in her thinking and reflecting on such an experience, this is what comes. It's the shock I remember. Not only does something come if you wait, but it pours over you like a waterfall, like a tidal wave. You wait in all naturalness, without expectation or hope, empty, translucent. And that which comes rocks and topples you. It will shear loose winnow grind. I have glutted on richness. This distant December day, these bare branches of trees showing their pure and secret colors. This is the real world, not the world gilded and pearled. I stand under white skies, naked, without intercessors. Frost winds have lifted my body's bones with all their restless spirits to an airborne raven's glide. I am buoyed by a calm and effortless longing. Thanks be to God. Not only does something come if you wait, but it pours over you like a waterfall, a tidal wave. What Ms. Dillard is describing here is one of those moments that take you completely out of yourself and into the deepest parts of yourself all at the same time. And this is what I meant when I said it is possible to be both overwhelmed and empowered all at the same time. That's what's happening in this experience that Ms. Dillard describes. And her response to this experience, to this ultimate kind of receiving, is to say, thanks be to God. That was her way of acknowledging, her way of giving voice to the simultaneous feeling of smallness in the face of the universe, as well as a largeness of soul. Well, while they've not been the same as described here, I have been blessed, as I hope you have as well, on occasion, with similar types of experiences, that experience of smallness in the face of the universe and the largeness of soul all at the same time, along with some connection of a greater reality that I can't even know or name. And certainly for her, Ms. Dillard's response to such an experience as that is, thanks be to God. For me, if I say or think anything at those times, my response is simply, from you, I receive. I'm not at all sure who the you even is in that sentence. The universe? Life itself? The great mystery? Who knows? It's the experience that's more important than the language that is used to describe it. But from you I receive works for me. Well then, we've gone from kind of a fluffy puffy book by John Grisham to what is probably a UU sermon extract by Clark Wells to a piece of spiritual autobiography by Annie Dillard. I would say that if there's one common element to be found in the three of them, it is that theme of receptivity. Laura, Luther, and Nora received a seasonal blessing in the face of, and in spite of, their resistance to a season they sought to avoid. Clark Wells discovered a deep sense of gratitude as he recalled the nicest gifts I've ever received. Annie Dillard declared that she had glutted on richness precisely because she was able to wait without expectation or hope. In closing, I especially like the part where Annie Dillard's piece, where she refers to the sky and the landscape as seeing this time of year as part of the real world, one stripped of all dressing, of all pretension. It's passages like these that help me to appreciate a winter season that I must confess I also easily grow weary of. For there is a beauty to be found in this season of giving and receiving, in this season of another calendar year coming to an end. So let's sing of that beauty as we sing our closing hymn. It's number 57, All Beautiful, March of Days.